Well, good evening. This is working properly. Does this sound good? So it's nice to be here with you. I think this is maybe about the fourth time I've come to Valley Streams. I came when it was Iron Bell. And it's exciting to be in what to me is still your new Dharma space. Really wonderful, this Dharma Center. And kind of, I've been here 3 days in a row in different guises or whatever. So it's offering many things here. It's really great. It's exciting. And it's exciting that you have this Zen Sangha here. So I have been thinking about and want to talk tonight about the subject of refuge. Which is what was the theme of our writing retreat on Saturday as well. And as you know, taking the refuges are essential foundational vows in our Buddhist practice. They're the first three of our 16 precepts. When we take the precepts, we vow to take refuge in the three treasures. And in this time, this very difficult time in our world, in our country, the idea of refuge seems to come up more. And it's a time when we all would like to find refuge, and we need to find refuge. We all need to find a way to feel at home and feel safe. Everybody deserves to feel safe or sheltered and at home, but everybody doesn't feel that way. And sometimes refuge refers to a specific place, a geographical place, a physical place like a wildlife refuge or church where people can seek sanctuary or harbor as a refuge from a storm, a country that people go to seek refuge from war in another country. But it also can be a spiritual place or an internal place. There's different aspects of refuge, and I want to touch on some thoughts about both of those ways of thinking about it, which are completely connected. It's also a time in this world when there are more refugees, more displaced people globally than there ever have been at any one time in our global history. And so many people fleeing for economic reasons and for war. And, you know, we hear about it in the news, and I was just looking up some numbers on the internet, and I just think particularly also of, there's a lot of families and children, and there are a lot of unaccompanied children now who are refugees, which is particularly heartbreaking. And there are, for example, I was just looking up, there are 3,000 unaccompanied children are refugees in Greece, 11,000 in France, 13,000 in Italy. These are kids traveling by themselves, some of them are fairly young, I think. I'm going to try and put these glasses on without messing up. Excuse me. Oh, my magic magnet glasses. Click. Okay. So anyway, I think particularly of the children, but you know, our heart just goes out to all the displaced people in the world, and we're pretty lucky in our own country, and yet here too we have many homeless people who are seeking refuge in another kind of way, and we have in California there are the homeless population is increasing, and the rest of the country, it turns out, it's going down slowly, but in California it's going up. cost of housing, I think, is part of that. And now also we have displaced people in our country because of fires and floods, and some of you may know displaced people, as I do, now from the recent fires. So it seems as though there's more and more refugees of different kinds in the world, and it's a scary time. And it's also a time when our country is becoming less welcoming as a place of refuge to people coming from other places. But it turns out in my readings that actually the United States has been a really good place for refugees to come historically. I mean, there have been a lot of problems, but the numbers from the United Nations figures that many, many more refugees have come to the United States than to any other single country for a number of years. So we have some tradition of welcoming people, and that's being a little bit, compromised indeed, yes.
Undermined.
Yeah. But we can keep the voices going to keep it alive, too. But as I was saying, refuge also means something that you can't see, and something spiritual or internal, and a sense of comfort, a sense of safety, a sense of belonging. And it's often connected with spiritual practice, and many religions include in them the idea of refuge or sanctuary. And I think of, well, of course, we have our, as I was saying, we have our three vows of refuge that are so essential to our practice. I was thinking of the Psalms, there a lot of the Psalms in the Bible, the Old Testament, refer to refuge. The 91st Psalm has in it the line, "The Lord is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him will I trust. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust." So that reminds me very much of a line in the hymn to Prajnaparamita that we chant. Do you chant that in this Sangha ever? An excerpt from? Yeah. Well, I want to read the version. It's probably the same piece that you chant, but we chant it in Everyday Zen and at Berkeley Zen Center. But there's a line in the original Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines that this is excerpted from, and the excerpt that we chant in our service drops out the line that reminds me so much of the 91st Psalm. So anyway, I'm going to read the excerpt with that line back in it. But this is a nice hymn to Prajnaparamita. It's a nice prayer for refuge in a way. "Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. The perfection of wisdom gives light. Unstained, the entire world cannot stain her. She is a source of light, and from everyone in the triple world she removes darkness. In her we can find shelter. Most excellent are her works. She makes us seek the safety of the wings of enlightenment. She brings light so that all fear and distress may be forsaken, and disperses the gloom and darkness of delusion. She herself is an organ of vision. She has a clear knowledge of the own being of all dharmas, for she does not stray away from it. The perfection of wisdom of the Buddhas sets in motion the wheel of the Dharma." So as you probably picked up, the line, "She makes us seek the safety of the wings of enlightenment." I love that line. A lot of lines had to be dropped out to make it a short piece, but I wish they'd kept that one in. But anyway, but it's so similar. "She makes us seek the safety of the wings of enlightenment. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust." So it's a feeling common to people all over that this is what we want, some sheltering in something sacred, perhaps. And then I was thinking that the Christmas story, yes, the nativity story is a story of a family finding refuge in a barn, in a stable. And so it's a very deep kind of seeking to seek refuge. So I want to go back to the Buddhist refuges, which, as you know, are, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. And I want to point to the word take in our translation. Why do we say take refuge? It's an active verb, and we have to do something about it. We have to engage with refuge. We can't just sit around and wait for refuge to come to us, to come along and take care of us. We have to take our refuge. We have to reach for it, which I think is really interesting and kind of important that, you know, it's sort of like God helps those who help themselves, and maybe you know the joke about the man I just thought of in a flood, and he's very deep believer in God, and he the floodwaters are rising, and somebody comes along, and at one point has to go up really high, and in this house, and a rowboat comes along and calls through the window and says, "You want a ride? Come on, I'll save you and take you to dry land." And he says, "No, that's all right. God will save me." And then the waters come a little bit higher, and he goes up onto the roof, and a helicopter comes along and says, "Come on, I'm lower a basket to you and save you." And the man says, no, that's all right. God will save me." And then after a while, he drowns and goes up to the gates of heaven and says, "Hey, God, why didn't you save me? I trusted you." And God says, "Well, what do you mean? I sent you a rowboat? I sent you a helicopter? What do you want?" So anyway, he wasn't able to take refuge, that guy. The word refuge it comes from Latin, re, back, and the fuge part comes from fugere, to fly, so it means to fly back. And I think of it as flying back to our own true nature. Returning to the ground of our being, or to our deep Buddha nature. That's how I think of that flying back. When I say the refuges, I've actually kind of translated them to myself, so I every morning I say the three refuges just as I said them to you, and then as we say them together, and then I say, I take refuge in my own true nature, I take refuge in things as they are, I take refuge in the community of which I am a part. And that's kind of the same thing to me as saying Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so I think of Buddha, taking refuge in Buddha is taking refuge in my Buddha nature, which is my own true nature, my deep nature. And it makes me think of a quotation I really love, which I mentioned on Saturday, and I ascribed to Blanche Hartman, but she quoted it a lot, but she was quoting Katagiri Roshi when she said this, which is that zazen is to sit zazen is to settle the self on the self and let the flower of your life bloom. So the flower of your life force bloom. So that's to me is a kind of taking refuge in my own true nature, settle the self on the self and let the flower of my life force bloom. And then it's a kind of plunging in. And I think of this, the chant when you sew a rakusu or a robe, and you take a vow with every stitch, you say, Namu Kye Butsu, I plunge into Buddha. With every stitch, you're taking refuge in Buddha. And I like to think of it as I plunge into Buddha. I just jump right in. So those are all ways that I understand that first part of taking refuge in Buddha. And then the second part, when I say I take refuge in things as they are, you know, we do speak of that in our practice, or things as it is, as Suzuki Roshi would say. What is it that's really here? We can take some kind of refuge in the actual moment that we're in and things just the way they are. And when I first heard of that, I thought, well, that's not right. We can't accept things as they are. They're not okay. And so how can we just take refuge in things as they are? We have to make them better and fix the things that are wrong. Well, now I can see that we have to, we can only get there from here, and we have to start where we are, and we have to see what's real. And so it's not the same thing as resigning yourself and saying, oh gosh, I guess I'll have to just accept this and go along with it and swallow my problems with it. No, it's not that at all. But, oh, what is here? Wow, this is what's here. And in a way, it is a kind of refuge, because if you're really seeing what's here, you're not fighting it. You're being present with it. You're giving yourself over to the situation that you see. And it's also a way to be present in this exact moment. And the present moment is where we all always are going to find our home. So what is it like right now? What is happening in this present moment? That's where I can find my home. And then maybe go on to the next moment, and maybe we'll have something to do with the karma of what unfolds. But let's start here. So that's one way of looking at taking refuge in Dharma, reality, or the truth of the situation. And then the third one, taking refuge in Sangha, or taking refuge in community, that's easy to understand. It's easy to want to take refuge, for me anyway, that kind of comes naturally, that, oh yes, that is a great place of refuge. And also I see, I mean, the Sangha originally meant the Sangha of the monks in practice together, monks and nuns. But Sangha has come to mean broader and broader things. Right, you can speak of the Valley Streams is your Sangha in the most literal and traditional sense. This is the wonderful Sangha that you're in. But then the Sangha gets bigger and bigger, all the way out to the Sangha of all beings, because we are all interconnected, and maybe the Sangha of the universe, and all the stars and everything are in our Sangha. But it's really the truth of interconnectedness. So that, I like that refuge a lot. Sometimes the word refuge can be translated as sanctuary. And there's a koan that you are probably familiar with, some of you, in the Book of Serenity, which is, the world-honored one points to the ground, case 4 in the Book of Serenity. When the world-honored one was walking with the congregation, he pointed to the ground with his finger and said, "This spot is a good place to build a sanctuary." Indra, emperor of the gods, took a single blade of grass, stuck it in the ground, and said, "The sanctuary is built." The world-honored one smiled. So we can build a sanctuary anywhere, really. Any place is already sacred. We can just stop where we are and find refuge there, find sanctuary there. It's a holy place wherever we are. As Reb Anderson says, there's no place to spit. That's a problem, I guess. I don't know if you have to spit. There's no place that deserves to be spat upon in a negative way, put it like that. So we can make a sanctuary anywhere, and in fact, as Indra, as the World Honored One says, as Indra says, the sanctuary is built. I mean, he just sticks a piece of grass in the ground, but really the sanctuary is already built wherever we go, if we could just see it. Just like we're already enlightened if we could just see it. So seeking refuge is not walling ourselves, trying to wall ourselves off from suffering. This is an important thing. It doesn't mean going into hiding somewhere. And if you think about refugees, that's hardly what they're doing. I mean, the refugees around the world are taking huge leaps and going into great danger to be refugees for something they really are needing and wanting and giving themselves over to. And if they make it across the Mediterranean to the shores of Italy, for example, it's not like the job is done. Their journey continues. And so, in a way, the seeking of refuge and the taking of refuge is an ongoing process, quite literally for them, but for all of us, it continues. And that's why we keep repeating these vows. We keep on saying, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. We have to keep on taking refuge. We have to keep seeking it, finding it, taking it, making it, all of those things. Offering it, sharing it. Sometimes, even though we can find it anywhere, sometimes it does make sense to go someplace nice and quiet and have a little restorative kind of refuge. Go do a practice period at Tassajara, for example, or to sit zazen. It seems like maybe you're going away from the busyness of the world, and you are, but you're not. We don't sit or we don't practice in order to separate ourselves from the suffering of the world. And to get away from it all, we practice in order to join with it in a way and to open our hearts and to become more able to meet what is out there. I think that it is also natural to find, you know, have this balance of maybe sometimes you're more out in the fray and sometimes you're more in a quiet place, but those are both parts of a full life. And as Norman Fisher says, you know, or other people say this too, I guess there's two parts of zazen. There's sitting down on the cushion and then there's getting up again. So those are the two parts of our practice. And seeking refuge includes the idea of getting up again, I think, or offering refuge to others in a way. And I was thinking about, as a child, I think children have a natural sense of this seeking a kind of sacred, special, quiet, secret place or something. And when I was a child, I had different places I would go, but there was, in the backyard of our house, there was an apple tree that I loved to climb, and it was... So I would go up to a certain crotch of the tree, kind of high up. So it was a job to get up there, and then I would sit there and I could read, I could dream, I could make up stories, I could stare into space, I could whittle on a stick with my beloved jackknife or whatever. And it was a kind of refuge place for me. And then I was thinking about this today, and I remembered this poem from, I think it's from Now We Are Six by A.A. Milne, or it's one of the two poetry books he wrote, the person who wrote Winnie the Pooh, and he has these wonderful books of poems for children, really. Anyway, this one goes like this. Halfway down the stairs is a stair where I sit. There isn't any other stair quite like it. It's not at the bottom, it's not at the top. So this is the stair where I always stop. Halfway up the stairs isn't up and isn't down. It isn't in the nursery. It isn't in the town. And all sorts of funny thoughts run through my head. It isn't really anywhere. It's somewhere else instead. So I think that's kind of like A.A. Milne's version of, this is a good place to build a sanctuary, right in the middle of the stairs. It's no place in particular. And all kinds of funny thoughts can run through your head. So that's sort of like Zazen, too. So we all have that in us to want that. And as adults, maybe we don't sit on a certain step of the stairs, but we can make a place in our homes. We can make an altar or a place to sit or a sort of special quiet corner. And Thich Nhat Hanh recommends this. I remember it made a big impression on me when I heard him, one of the times I heard him talk, and he was saying, everybody should have some kind of altar. It doesn't have to have a Buddha figure on it, but a peaceful place, a peaceful corner in your house where you can take care of it, and it's just small and easy to keep track of and keep clean, or, you know, dusted, or put a flower there, put a rock there, whatever. Make it a place of peace. Even if the house is in chaos and there's unfolded laundry everywhere and you know, dishes in the sink and papers all over your desk, you can still go to this quiet corner, and that place, you can keep it peaceful and quiet. And I find that very comforting, because sometimes there are a lot of places in my house that don't feel so peaceful and quiet. I do have an altar that I can go look at and light a stick of incense and feel like, okay, I'm creating the visual component and the fragrance also with a flower or with incense of a peaceful practice place. It is with us. We can keep it with us. And when I went to Tassajara for a practice period, I just have been able to do that once, and it was a dream of mine to do it for a long time. But now it was a long time ago that I went there, 25 years ago. And while I was there, I thought, oh, this is going to be so peaceful and everything. And then I was just in agony because my Zazen was so unpeaceful and my mind was racing around, and I could not stop my anxieties and my chatter, and I was so disappointed in myself, and I thought there was something wrong with me, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who had some of those thoughts, but I talked to Reb about it, who was leading the practice period, and he said, read case 21 of the Book of Serenity. So I went and looked up case 21 of the Book of Serenity, which is Yunyan was sweeping the ground. Dao Wu said, too busy. Yunyan said, you should know there is one who is not busy. Dao Wu said, if so, then there's a second moon. Yunyan said, held up the broom and said, which moon is this? So, and I hadn't heard of that koan before, and it was just came like a bolt of lightning. Oh, and it's a plus. It's about the moon. There's only one moon, and that's me. I thought it was specially written for me. No, and it was specially written for me, and specially written for all of us, really. But the idea that in the midst of whatever busyness, the busy mind or the busy place, there is one who is not busy. That's like Thich Nhat Hanh's little corner of refuge in your house. There's a place that is not busy, but there's one inside, and we can keep connecting to that one and finding ways to learn to remember the one who is not busy. And that's been a really important practice for me. That's why on my license plate says Yunyan, because I'm so grateful to Yunyan for teaching me about the one who is not busy. But also, very importantly, when we seek refuge or take refuge, we don't do it for ourselves alone. We offer refuge back. We do it for everyone together. And And we don't actually find refuge in isolation. We can't find it all by ourselves. It doesn't really exist in complete isolation. It's offered by the universe. And if you know, you can go, even if you're a hermit, in the mountains, you're finding refuge in the life around you, the mountains, the water, the streams, the clouds, which is life too. And Ryokan, the Japanese poet who lived in a hermitage in the mountains, writes a lot about being a hermit and living alone in the mountains. But then he loved and also often felt terribly lonely in his mountain hermitage. But he also would come out and go down to the village and play with the children, and he would go visit a friend and drink sake and write drunken poetry together. And so he saw himself as not existing alone, and people would come and visit him as well. So refuge needs to be supported by a community of some kind in some way. And we need to offer it back too. I think that's really essential. One of the writing exercises we did on Saturday, which is really touching, was that I asked people to write about a time they had offered refuge to someone else, and wonderful stories came out. And I think there's something in all of us that wants to offer refuge. And it doesn't have to be, I mean, it could be that you have a Syrian family come and live in your garage, but it doesn't have to be that. It could be that you serve in a food kitchen one evening, or it could be that you adopt a rescue animal, there's so many ways of offering refuge, and there's so much refuge that needs to be offered. But to keep that alive in yourself is really a wonderful feeling, that you can offer something to someone else. And it can be a shoulder to cry on for a friend. And it can be coming together with other people and creating a Dharma center. How about that for refuge? And taking care of this altar and bringing flowers. And so you're all offering refuge already. So I think refuge really is being fully present in your own life, in our own lives together, and it's just in refuge in our awakeness, in our aliveness that is already given to us. So those are some of my thoughts about it, and I wanted to stop and have some time for discussion, comments, questions, whatever. I'm interested in what others of you might think about refuge, or where you find it, or how you offer it, or what we can do about how badly we need it, or anything that comes up for you.
The other day I was reading a study where people who, I forget the amount of time, but a certain amount of access to like green spaces a week have like markedly less anxiety and depression. And I know that kind of mirrors my own experience. Like, you know, I don't get I need a certain prerequisite amount of nature experience, mm-hmm. like kind of refuge in that. Or just, you know, I'd feel really disconnected. You know, so that's kind of probably my primary refuge. I mean, maybe the other than song or whatever. But.
Thank you for saying that. That came up a lot in our Saturday retreat day too, and how many people mentioned nature. And you know, we say take refuge in nature as if, which shows how kind of alienated we are from nature in the first place in a way, because we are part of nature already, but that is so crucial to feel that connection. And I think it's also something our planet needs us all to do, to realize that we're connected, and that when, you know, when the forests are dying, that's getting to us too. But and many people also mentioned city parks, and so the greenness that is available in urban areas is so important too. There's something about green things growing, that just the chlorophyll it must, well, and the air that it makes for us to breathe. You know, it's life to us.
There's a point that Kaiser Permanente mentioned in their newsletter that if you walk barefoot on grass, there's a chemical change that comes up through the soles of your feet.
Really? That's fantastic. I never heard that. Did you hear what he said? I'm going to remember that, because it feels that way when you walk barefoot on the grass. Yeah. A calming chemical comes up through the soles of my feet.
The Japanese have a word for forest bathing.
Oh.
Because the trees are part of the refuge. They actually have a word for it.
As bathing. It's a kind of bathing. That's great. It's really, it feels that way. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Wherever you go, there's a bathtub.
Right. A hot tub. So I was going to say that even though I've been meditating for some time, I feel I'm just learning to take refuge in the breath. Even though I've been hearing that teaching for a long time, and what's underneath the breath, the body sense underneath the breath. So I guess it's an ongoing study.
Yeah, that's a good reminder, though, because some of the simplest things are the things where we go for refuge, like the breath. And it is hard to find refuge in the breath. I agree with you. It's kind of challenging practice, and yet it's so simple. Yeah. Refuge in the body, too, just in the sensations of the body. Yes, Bob.
Thank you so much for your talk. I've always had problems with the refuges. There's been something about, you know, I take refuge in, which sounds sort of escapist, and maybe I'm counter-dependent or whatever. Someone once suggested that I say I return to Buddha. I really liked the way you translated the vows that you do each morning, and then I was sitting here going, so I still haven't found anything which works for me. You know, how can I translate this? I take refuge sounds sort of grabby.
Mm-hmm.
I make refuge, well, that sounds kind of good, except making, well, what about, you know, the unborn and the uncreated, and that's what we're really trying to go to. And then the words which kind of popped up was, I goes round and round with Buddha.
I goes round and round with Dharma.
And I kind of liked that, so I just...
Well, maybe you've got your own translation now. That's great.
Yeah.
I like that, too. Yeah. It's a relationship.
Yeah, to get the relationship in that it's, as you were saying, it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps refreshing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I keep forgetting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in the formal commitment, if you will, of taking refuge. You know, like Christianity, they have, you know, what's it called? Catechism and all of that stuff. In my tradition, we have an actual ceremony. And
which is your tradition?
Tibetan.
Oh, yeah.
So there's an actual commitment, you know, and we're kind of, I haven't heard much, I didn't hear you talk about that, but I know that that's got to be a big piece.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we take the vows, we take the precept, we again say take. And sometimes we say we take the precepts, sometimes we say we receive the precepts. But anyway, whichever we say, excuse me, it happens as an act of commitment. When you have dukkhai, that's an act of commitment. And the first vows are the refuge vows. So I guess it's maybe not spoken of as a commitment, but it's part of a commitment ceremony of the dukkhai, or then every other stamp, an ordination as a priest, or dharma transmission, or the lay entrustment ceremony. And then for people who aren't doing those particular passages or wearing those particular costumes, if you want to think of it that way, they can still be making that commitment and still taking the refuges as we do them. So I'm interested in the Tibetan practice. I guess it really is more of a distinct moment of commitment to take refuge. Is that right? Maybe you could tell us a bit about that, how it works.
It probably differs from temple to temple, but the ones that I've seen and the ones that I've participated in, the teacher, you go up to the teacher and he says, or she says, do you know what you're doing? do you want to do this? Do you understand what the precepts are? It can be more or less complicated. Mm-hmm. But generally you have to have several meetings with the teacher first, and so that they really feel some sort of a connection to mm-hmm. the student. Then there's, in our tradition, there's actually a name given.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's not uncommon. And, then there's a party. But
well, I think it is that way in Soto Zen, too. Yeah, I mean, we get Jukai, you get a name, you get a new name, and you think a lot. You work with the teacher who says, okay, I think you can sew your rakusu now, and you take a long time to do that. So it's definitely a commitment.
And you're asked three times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. And I'm slow at making commitments, and I was so anti-authoritarian when I started practicing at Berkeley Zen Center. I just kept going and thinking, God, how could I be in a place like this? It's so patriarchal, and it's so authoritarian. And I had a bumper sticker on my car that said, question authority, and I just kept, I don't know if this is the right place for me. I don't know if this is the right place for me. And 9 years later, I noticed I was still saying, I don't know if this is the right place for me. I thought, gee, I guess maybe it is the right place for me. I guess I'll go ahead and have Jukai. And I experienced it as a definite commitment and a sort of relief in willingness to say, oh, okay, I'll do this. I'll go over this.
When I was thinking of the refugees who are, going across the Mediterranean, huge. I mean, just the hugeness of their commitment.
You're right. That is really a commitment.
Oh, it's just
to get into those boats or whatever.
Terrifying.
Terrifying.
So the refugees, it really does mean mm-hmm. some sort of a commitment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is a kind of, like the idea of plunging into Buddha. It's that you're plunging into something, and you don't know what's going to happen. Doralee. Did you want to say something, Raphael?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Maybe,
Mike? Hold it up to your mouth, yeah.
Mike?
Good.
I wanted to get a perspective on refuge. And so I was thinking about the gentleman that was out there. He may have wanted to come in here as a place of refuge and didn't know how to ask. And so he was in place where he didn't know how to. And so thinking of refuge as a place, or thinking of refuge as a state of being,
mm-hmm.
And so I've always had this idea of wanting to take refuge in a place that was safe. And I never quite found a way to get there or to be there. And now that I'm in a space, a place where I can feel safe, I don't know that I want to take refuge and be comfortable in that or complacent in that. And so I want to maybe not get stuck on a place of refuge, but always seeking to be in a place where I can not be comfortable. I don't want to be comfortable. I want to always be in a space of doing. Everywhere I go in Sacramento, I seem to want to be in a place where someone can, in some way I can touch them, help them, and feel what they're feeling, and not just be comfortable in what I'm feeling. Because I don't think that's where I really get a realization in my life, is just being with myself or being somewhere safe. But really going out there and finding a way to be connected and not necessarily safe, but just connected in that space where I'm practicing saving all beings. That's, now there's a good place to be, and it's not necessarily a refuge, because it's not necessarily safe. And you know, everywhere I go, everywhere I see, it's anywhere, there's no safety. There's always something happening that says, well, a place of refuge is not necessarily what I'm looking for. It's not where I want to be.
Well, thank you so much. What you're saying is so important and beautiful. And yes, we can't just find refuge for ourselves or get stuck in some safe, there isn't a really safe place. You're right. And thank you for reminding us of the man who was outside, who was probably seeking refuge in some way that maybe we couldn't understand or couldn't offer, or maybe there was a way we should have offered him refuge that we didn't, or, you know, these questions keep coming up and they're alive questions. So we can't get too comfortable, and your continuing desire to be able to be in a place where you can be helpful to other people, that's what it's all about, really. So I'm very grateful to you for reminding us of that. That's really important and valuable. Thank you. Maybe we could have one more person, because it's, or is it time to stop? Or?
Oh, you have yours. Go ahead.
Is it turned red?
It's red.
There.
I think, is it working?
Yes. Oh,
okay, thank you. Well, I'm just very moved and sitting with what you were saying, Raphael, and somehow it connects, because I was thinking that maybe for me, refuge isn't the word so much as relinquishment. And there's something about bowing and relinquishing something that I am holding on to or that I need. And it is like I'm throwing myself into the center of the light, or, but it is throwing myself into, I don't know, what's coming next or what's arising next, and it has a sort of quality of courage coming towards me through that.
That's great. Yeah, thank you. Do you think, do we have time for Karen to have the last word?
What Raphael is saying reminds me of Nowhere to Stand.
Yes.
So how do you reconcile taking refuge with nowhere standing?
Yeah, that's a good question and a good koan. And every you can stand anywhere and there's nowhere to stand. You know, both are true, that maybe there's nowhere to stand forever, or you can't stay still in the same place for long, maybe. But again, as Dogen says, you cover the ground wherever you stand, completely cover the ground. Like your feet are completely covering the piece of ground you're standing on. So that you are standing someplace, but maybe it's also the idea that you're standing there with because the earth is letting you. It's not just something you take for granted. I don't know.
Well,
it's a good question.
I was just thinking that it means don't like he was saying actually, don't take refuge as a place to discomfort yourself.
Yes, yes.
Taking refuge is a tool.
Yes.
Maybe you know, like you were saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
You sent the boat. I sent the helicopter, and you didn't take
it. Yeah.
You didn't use.
Yeah.
You didn't use what I offered.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's a good reminder to end with. Thank you all very much for your